This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 537, I think. Don't know when to quit. So it's been a good week. The weather has been lovely this week again. It's starting to warm up a little bit. Some people are thinking, oh, it's getting hot. And I'm just like, I love this. Helps to grow up in the Philippines. I got tickled today because I often refer to systems as the monkeys just as a kind of a way to help users relate to what's going on, because I can tell them, you know, you just got to keep the monkeys in the barrel, and if the monkeys get out of the barrel, then bad things happen. You know, there's a lot of analogies you can draw. Well, I was talking today about a little bug that I had introduced, didn't realize I had introduced it on a form, got that fixed today, we'll deploy it next week, and one of the people that I work with sent me back a picture of a monkey picking bugs off another monkey's back. And so having grown up in the Philippines, I was able to write back and said, yeah, growing up, I had a little tree monkey, and he used to do that to me. So, you know, it's just, what a wonderful way to grow up. Missionary kid. I am going to need to make a quick stop today. I have a tire that's low, so I'm going to swing by a gas station on the way home and get that tire aired up. I noticed it when I was walking by the car today, and we'll get that taken care of, but that shouldn't be too much of an interruption, especially since there's a pause button. Let's see, last week I did the podcast after Uncle Sam Day, so the only thing I'd say about that at this point is the lost has been found. One of the things I wanted to have with me on Uncle Sam Day was my sunglasses that are stars and stripes. They're blue sunglasses with stars and stripes on them. Could not find them for the life of me. I look it. I prayed and asked Jesus to help me. I could not find them. Apparently, I was not listening very well. So I was looking for my tire gauge just a few moments ago, and lo and behold, if they weren't in the car, in the center console storage. So that's all right. So I didn't have them last week, but, you know, I'll have them next year or something. We'll go from there. And when I found those, I found my long-lost coin as well. So, goodness, it is time for celebrations. I have a silver coin from the Republic of Panama. It's 1934. It's not really worth much of anything. It's called a Balboa, and I usually carry it around with me. I have not been carrying it with me for, multiple months, because I couldn't find it, and I just found it as well. Just goes to show you that sometimes it's good to look in that center console storage on your car. Anyways, so writing is pottering along. This is really the first big full week of writing on book 11. It's going okay. I'm a little bit behind this week, but I'm hoping to get caught up this weekend. And it's always, you know, I finished doing the read through last week, and that took a little longer than I expected, but I was already at, you know, 95,000 words or so, and I was able to get to 100,000 words, which was technically the goal for last week. And so the goal for this week is to get to 110,000 words, and then I have hopefully about four more weeks beyond this, and I can get the book wrapped up then, somewhere around 150, maybe 160,000 words. I think I'm on track. Exactly what happens from here on out is a little vague in my mind. I know kind of where I'm going as usual, but man, I don't really have like a big finish on this thing, but I think that'll be okay. I got some ideas to kind of, it'll be fine. It's book 11. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. There's enough that has happened momentously in book 11 that even if there isn't some kind of a big finish, as long as I get some kind of a nicey-nice finish on it, it'll be fine. Because we're in a little bit of a lull at this point, which is where we're supposed to be. We're ramping up to the end of the second set of 8 books. So, you know, on the way to 3 sets of 8 books, entire series is 24 books. And this is book 11. But that, you know, I think we're fine. We'll see where this goes. This is a fascinating exercise. So that's good. Family's good. Although my poor beloved has been sick. And she's doing the music for a church every year here in town has like a 2-day thing called camp meeting, I think they call it. And it's just nice, you know, they do a lot of the old songs and have a speaker come in, and it technically is for their seniors ministry, but you know, anybody can come. And so Lynette's working on that this week, and she has been sick. Oy, sick. She got this kind of sinusy thing. Ow. Like someone has pulled into the air where I was gonna go. So I might go around if I can get moved over here. We're gonna try this. Although they haven't gotten out yet, but I don't suppose it would be very good if I if I hopped in front of them. But I know of another air place that I can get my tired air up, so I'm heading over there. But she's been sick, and so we've all been kind of praying for her, and she said she was doing a little better yesterday, so that started today, and hopefully all will go well for that. It's always good when she has an opportunity like this to lead worship. She enjoys it. I mean, obviously it's a little extra load, but she enjoys it, and people seem to enjoy her and her worship style or leading style, especially the older crowd, of which I count myself a part of now, since this last week I changed the board. Boom. 6.0. The board now reads 6.0. Exactly 6 years until I retire. Whoop whoop. So retirement will technically come on July the 5th, 2020, but I think I won't probably start drawing money from my SEP till sometime around July the 13th, because that's when my anniversary date is with them, and if I don't draw up to that point, I get another 5%. Da-da-da! So all is well there. So all is well with the family, all is well at work. Work is going good. It's going good. We're in the process of doing some reorganization, and I'm really encouraged. And I was working on a design document today, and I think I've got that roughed in now. And so I think it's good. What's coming is good. It's big, and it's complicated, and there's a lot of moving pieces. But you know, step at a time. One step at a time, Jesus will help us. So that's good. And then, you know, we'll go. I heard back from the doctor on the MRI stuff from my little interesting episode back in the beginning of June. Oh, that's the other thing that happened this week. We closed another month on the new system. Yay! Yay! And it went better than last month. Yay! So, that's good. It didn't go horrible last month. People got paid. That's the important part. People got paid. You know, this month it went better and it was fun because there's actually two divisions who are using the, man, people are wanting to get air. I may just have to get in line. So there are two different divisions, and one division goes first, and then the second division goes. And the way it was set up, we had an extra day of vacation this last week. I think I mentioned that they gave everybody an extra day of vacation, which was cool. Gave them the 5th. We weren't necessarily intending for them to have the 5th, and we have so many business days after the close of the month where that first division is supposed to get done, and then we move on to the second division. And that was a little exciting because when they gave the extra day of vacation, then that threw us out a month, or threw us off a day. And so the programmer who's in charge of the project was saying, yeah, it would have been great. Oh, wait, I gotta pause this. I'll be right back. Okay, done and done. Got my tire aired up, so we're good there. Anyways, so the first division needed to finish, and then the second division was coming up, and the programmer was a little concerned. He said, man, because the first division could have run on the 3rd, but they didn't, because they were waiting for some things. So then we weren't there on the 5th, and then, of course, there was the weekend, and so that put us to the 8th, and we're really supposed to be done with everything by the 10th. You know, it kind of slimmed down our margin for error, but boy, we got there on the 8th, and the first division, the person who ran that, had come in early on the 8th, started at 7 o'clock, just hammered through what she needed to get done, and poof, you know, by the time we were gearing up, everything was ready to go, and went through, yay, yay, yay. So, there you go. Anyway, so the MRI results came back, and my primary care physician looked at them and said, you know, they said there are a few of your blood vessels are a little enlarged, but just exercise and eat well, and ta-da. I do that, so, you know, we go from there. So that's all good. I do have an appointment with a neurologist in August sometime, second week of August or so. But, you know, at this point, it just looks like a software glitch, and we'll move forward. Anyways, today, as listeners to this podcast will know, I'm always fascinated when I see out in the world the secular people, those who do not provide religious explanations to things, are trying to come up with a secular explanation for what is happening in the phenomenon that they observe. And especially, as listeners to this podcast will know, I'm fascinated by identification of what I would call flesh, since this has been kind of one of the hallmarks that I feel like has really helped me in my life, and a better understanding of the war that is within us between flesh and spirit. And it's interesting to me then to see manifestations of that war in the secular press, and then review how they're trying to explain what is happening. Because, obviously, they are not going to attach to a spiritual concept like flesh and spirit. As Paul does in Galatians 5, starting at about, I think, verse 16, where he goes through the whole thing. You know, he says, the flesh is opposed to the spirit, wars against the spirit is another way to say it. Spirit is opposed to the flesh, and then he says, here's the works of the flesh, and then here's the fruit of the spirit. So really creates a clear dividing line for us about what our behavior should look like and what drives different types of behaviors that occur within us. So, the name of this article, which immediately seemed interesting to me, was Power Causes Brain Damage. It's like, what? Wait, what? Power Causes Brain Damage. The article is by Jeremy Usim, or Usim, I don't know. And he starts off by saying, if power were a prescription drug, it would come with a long list of known side effects. It can intoxicate. It can corrupt. It can even make Henry Kissinger believe that he's sexually magnetic. But can it cause brain damage? And he gives the example of the CEO of Wells Fargo. I believe his name is John Stumpf. That the CEO of Wells Fargo had been called to testify in Congress over the fact that some 5,000 customers had set up phony accounts, or 5,000 employees had set up phony accounts for customers in Wells Fargo, which is not good. And there were a bunch of the senators that were unhappy about this in his testimony, and they were just doing whatever they could to say, you know, we cannot believe this, that kind of stuff. I mean, they were hitting him with, like, comments of, you've got to be kidding me. I can't believe some of what I'm hearing. I mean, they're just upset. And yet, John Stumpf, apparently, I didn't see the hearings, through all of these very pointed and disturbing allegations and observations, you know, just kind of sat there and really didn't seem to faze him that much. He said, although he apologized, he didn't appear chastened or remorseful, nor did he seem defiant or smug or insincere. He said, basically, he just looked disoriented, like a jet-lagged space traveler just arrived from planet Stumpf, where deference to him is a natural law, and 5,000 is a commendably small number. And so, you know, the article goes on to say, so what is going on here? Why does this guy just like, well, whatever? And according to the author of this article, perhaps what's going on here in his mind is not what is happening in his head, but what is not happening in his head. The historian Henry Adams, the article quotes, was being metaphorical, not medical, when he described power as a sort of tumor that ends by killing its victim's sympathies. But according to Dr. Keltner, a psychology professor at UC Berkeley, that's not far off. So, apparently, neuroscientists and psychologists, they've been doing experiments. And specifically, they've been focusing on experiments around a process called mirroring. And in mirroring, what's happening is this amazing ability that we have as human beings to empathize with others, to see something and imagine for ourselves what that would feel like, what the other person is experiencing. That's a really valuable skill for us, because it means that we then have a fighting chance, really, of building culture, building society. Because if you have absolutely no empathetic response to anyone around you, we call that sociopath or psychopath. I mean, it's bad. The result of that is bad. So they would do experiments where they would try to figure out how empathetic a person was. And one of these experiments, which I have to admit I might have failed the first time because I wasn't really thinking about it, at least that's the excuse I'll use, is they asked, let's see, those feeling powerful, let me get this, because this was an interesting thing. Okay, so a 2006 study asked participants to draw the letter E on their forehead for others to view, a task that requires seeing yourself from an observer's vantage point. Those feeling powerful were three times more likely to draw the E the right way to themselves, which means it's backwards to everyone else. And I do have to say, when I did this the first time, I got it wrong. But that's an interesting experiment. They had another experiment where they were monitoring brain patterns. And what they were doing was, they said mirroring is a subtle kind of mimicry that goes on entirely within our heads and without our awareness. When we watch someone perform an action, the part of the brain we would use to do that same thing lights up in sympathetic response. It might be best understood as a vicarious experience. One moment, getting my mail. It's what Obhi, name of the researcher, Obhi and his team were trying to activate when they had their subjects watch a video of someone's hand squeezing a rubber ball. So they would monitor their brains, they'd have them play a video, watch them squeezing a ball, and they would see if that region in the brain of the observer lit up. They said for non-powerful participants, the mirroring worked fine. The neural pathways that they would use to squeeze the balls fired strongly. But for the powerful group, less so. So that's pretty interesting. They said, was the mirroring response broken? No, it was more like anesthetized. None of the participants possessed permanent power. They were college students who had been primed to feel potent by recounting an experience in which they had been in charge. The anesthetic would presumably wear off when the feeling did. Their brains weren't structurally damaged after an afternoon in the lab. But if the effect had been long-lasting, say, having by dint of having Wall Street pulling into my garage, analysts whispering their greatness quarter after quarter, board members offering them extra helpings of praise, and Ford praising them for doing well while doing good, they may have in medicine what is known as functional changes to the brain. So this is interesting. So the author of the article went on to say, I wondered whether the powerful might simply try to stop putting themselves in others' shoes without losing the ability to do so. As it happened, Obhi ran a subsequent study that may help answer that question. This time, subjects were told what mirroring was and asked to make a conscious effort to increase or decrease their response. Our results, Obhi told, and his co-author, Catherine Naish, wrote, showed no difference. Effort didn't help. So the author of the article goes on to say, that's a depressing finding. Knowledge is supposed to be powerful, but what good is knowing that power deprives you of knowledge? So, you know, it's all very interesting. He goes on to say, power, the research said, primes our brain to screen out peripheral information. In most situations, this provides a helpful efficiency boost. In social ones, it has the unfortunate side effect of making us more obtuse. Even that is not necessarily bad for the prospects of the powerful or the groups they may lead. As Susan Fisk, a Princeton psychology professor, has pervasively argued, power lessens the need for a nuanced read of people, since it gives us command of resources we once had to cajole from others. But of course, in modern organization, the maintenance of that command relies on some level of organizational support. And the sheer number of examples of executive hubris that bristle from the headlines suggests that many leaders cross the line into counterproductive folly. So, you know, this is very interesting to me. Because if I was guessing within my framework of flesh and spirit, I would say, well, it is the feelings of power that the flesh then exploits to create noise within us. And it basically tells us, oh, you don't need those little people anymore. And in terms of finding out how to combat this, the author says, is there nothing that can be done? And he says, no and yes. It's difficult to stop power's tendency to affect your brain, which I would submit that, in fact, what's happening is that when you are acquiring resources, then the flesh sees that as a new avenue of attack. And so then it begins lying to you and telling you that, well, now that you have these resources, you can behave in this way. But their suggestion, they said, what's easier to do to try to stop this, as opposed to just identifying the lies of the flesh within you, which would be my recommendation, what's easier from time to time, at least, is to stop feeling powerful. And they told a couple of cute things as to how this might come about. They were talking about Pepsi's CEO and chairman, Indra Nooyi, sometimes tells the story of the day she got the news of her appointment to the company's board in 2001. She arrived home percolating in her own sense of importance and vitality. When her mother asked her whether before she delivered her great news, she would go out and get some milk. Fuming, Nooyi went out and got it. And then her mother's advice when she was returned was, leave that blankety blank crown in the garage. So her mom apparently was feeling that Nooyi was thinking really highly of herself. And so her mom just kind of cut her down a little bit, which I don't. Okay, maybe, yes. Maybe that's helped cut her down to size, but it's. I would also say that the mom's response was flesh-driven as well, maybe because it was irritating her that her daughter thought she was doing so well. But anyways, it does help, though. It certainly does help when we have people in our lives who are good about observing us and then helping us to understand what they see happening in our lives. The author of the article does talk about Winston Churchill. The person who filled this role for him was his wife, Clementine, who had the courage to write, "My darling Winston, I must confess that I have noticed a deterioration in your manner, and you are not as kind as you used to be." Written on the day Hitler entered Paris, torn up and then sent away, the letter was not a complaint, but an alert. Someone had confided to her, she wrote, that Churchill had been acting so contemptuous toward subordinates in meetings that no idea, quote, no ideas, good or bad, will be forthcoming, with the attendant danger that you won't get the best results. There's another quote in here from Jonathan Davidson, hubris syndrome. Owen, Lord David Owens, and his co-author Jonathan Davidson defined it in a 2009 article published in Brain. Hubris syndrome is a disorder of the possession of power, particularly power which has been associated with overwhelming success, held for a period of years with minimal constraint on its leader. Its 14 clinical features include manifest contempt for others, loss of contact with reality, restless or reckless actions, and displays of incompetence. I mean, and that all sounds like flesh to me. Because the flesh is always, it's always looking for ways to distort our lives and lie to us and push us in whatever area. And it's certainly happier when we fail and has stuff to work with. But when we succeed then, well, it's going to take that and try to push that into failure as well. Lord David Owens, the author, asked Owens, who admits to a healthy predisposition to hubris himself, whether anything helps him keep tethered to reality, something that other truly powerful figures might emulate. He shared a few strategies. Thinking back on hubris, dispelling episodes from his past. 2, watching documentaries about ordinary people. 3, making a habit of reading constituents' letters. But I surmise that the greatest check on Owen's hubris today might stem from his recent research endeavors. Businesses, he complained to me, had shown next to no appetite for research on hubris. Business schools were not much better. The undercurrent of frustration in his voice attested to a certain powerlessness. Whatever the salutary effect on Owen, it suggests that a malady seen too commonly in boardrooms and executive suites is unlikely to find a cure soon. So there you go. And again, if in fact this is caused by the flesh, if in fact the flesh, once it sees that there is success and there's no denying the success, that it is apparent, and that it is being manifested, and there's nothing more you can gain by telling lies that the person has failed, then what it will do is it'll flip the other direction. And now it will tell you what a wonderful person you are because you're so successful. And, you know, it's just you've risen above the little people. And obviously your opinion of what to do next is more important than everybody else's opinion because, ta-da, you are the powerful one. And it's very easy for us as human beings to listen to that, especially when we have achieved some successes in our lives. But you can identify that lie just as easily as you can identify the demeaning lies that the flesh tries to tell you that you'll never be a success. We just have to pay attention. And anything that moves us into any sort of accusatory pattern, anything that moves us to be a scatterer as opposed to a builder, anything that moves us towards any sort of destructive behavior, there's always a lie behind that. That if we can ferret it out and get some truth on it, get some light on it, we can dispel it. This is Phil Ferrand. And I have made it home.